All right, guys, welcome to Crosstalk. We are here in South Florida, and I hope you like the podcast. Please subscribe to our channel. It helps us a lot if you do like it to subscribe and share it. Comment on whatever you want, questions, how you feel about it, what you like, what you don't like. We're open to feedback. Our goal as a 401c3 company, which means we're a nonprofit, is to raise money eventually for people who need treatment or need help and can't afford it. So please, we want to, you know, help as many people as possible. Anyway, today I have Veronica. She's a good friend of mine. She's here to former colleague as well. Yeah. So welcome, Veronica. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited.
Me too.
So here on Crosstalk, we kind of go through and you're going to tell your story, tell us, you know, the nitty gritty as deep as you want to get into it. And really just how you got sober and how you got into recovery and what your life is like today. So welcome.
Thank you. Well, I don't think it's something that you plan or even know how you got here. Like for me, it's even hard to tell my story because, you know, it's happening year over year over year over year, and you don't notice until you get to a place that your life is out of control.
Right.
But especially for someone like me, because I grew up in such a happy family, no trauma. Really, very loving parents. I was the youngest of three. I have two older brothers, so I was always the little spoiled princess. And I think one thing now, looking back after a year of nonstop therapy, that led me to my substance abuse is my perfectionism, which I think stemmed from being a ballerina.
Right.
You get thrown in the world where mistakes aren't really allowed from very young. All about perfection. How you look, what time you get there. And yes, it teaches you great discipline, but there's very little room for mistakes. Mm. And eyes are always on you. You're basically quite literally naked. From the age of three in a leotard. So you're very exposed, and that translates into every aspect of your life. For me specifically in school, starting just middle school, high school, I would cry myself to sleep if I got an A-. That was not allowed in my mind. So my parents
What about in your family?
My parents were like, she's crazy. She's crazy. Like an A minus is good, you know? So they never had to put pressure on me for my grades, but they also never said like, listen, it's okay to get a B.
Right.
Which could have been helpful. But yeah, I very much imposed that pressure on myself. And once I got past college, I did very well in college as well. And into the work world, things got harder, and maybe I wasn't able to study for what came, because that's not real life.
Right.
So for someone that was a straight A student, but I over prepared for everything, I couldn't prepare for life. Okay. So I was like, what can I grasp at?
Right. What can I control?
And
so as a kid, when you were doing, you grew up where? Here?
I grew up in Colombia until I was 7 years old and moved to Miami.
Okay.
Where we had a summer house because it was really unsafe in Colombia.
Yeah.
And there was a kidnapping attempt against me. Someone in my father's company had sold them out. He takes her out on the jet ski on the weekends, and they found out. And on the next plane, we were out. The next day, we were on a plane to Miami.
So as you were younger, you know, you said you started ballet when you were like 3 years old. Mm-hmm. So then that means you changed company, like ballet company, right?
Oh, yes.
Which must have played a role in the perfectionism and like fitting in and everything. Because I remember I did ballet when I was younger, and it's like those girls aren't very friendly. I mean, not when you're that age.
No, or my teacher when I moved to Miami, my first ballet teacher, Miss Albertina. I'm going to share this video.
I remember
video.
Mine. It was Dorit. Oh, my God. I hope
she would hit us with a stick.
Oh, my God. And
that, to me, was normal.
Wow. No, Dorit wasn't that bad. And actually, I saw my ballet teacher when I was older and deep in addiction. And I was really skinny from not eating because of my addiction. And she was like, "You look so good. You finally lost weight and all this stuff." And I was like, oh my God, this woman's crazy. But yeah, I mean, the pressure is really tough.
Right. And then that world of having to be perfect actually became my comfort because I didn't speak the language very well.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I was in excelling at making friends or at school because there was a little bit of that language barrier, and in ballet there is not.
Right.
So I leaned into that.
Meanwhile, your English is perfect and your grammar and everything is better than mine.
So. I'm a grammar police nowadays, yeah. You see.
But so when you were, I just want to like, you know, because I do think that those younger years play a big role in, you know, how we are and how our like behaviors that lead to addiction manifest. Like, for example, for me, it led to like some eating, you know, some concerns around eating disordered behavior. And, you know, I went to Greece one summer and I gained weight. And then the ballet teacher was like, "You can't be in the company anymore." Mm-hmm. And that was like hurtful for me. You know, I really didn't, you know, that affected me for sure. I mean, I don't think about it today, but if I think about it and think about that part of my life, it definitely affected my thinking.
100%. And you don't notice that until you're in recovery.
Right.
Even if it's from substances. In the past year, I realized through therapy that I have obvious issues with food and body image.
Right.
That stem from that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So did you act out as a child? Like, I know you say you're perfect, but was there anything like behind closed doors you were doing? Like, did you start taking caffeine pills or, you know, was there any alcohol issues or anything like that? Like, when did you start your substance use?
It was really after college.
Okay. So like me, like.
But I'll tell you, would have been earlier had I not been so focused on being the perfect child mm-hmm. and never getting in trouble.
Right.
I had my older brother, he was a terror, like ran away from home, just a terror. And I saw my mom cry herself to sleep and I was like, that's never going to be me. Mm. And I think that played a role.
Oh, I can relate
was like,
to that.
I have to be perfect. I cannot. And then you're out in the real world and boom, the late adolescence, as my mom calls it. So it was really out in the work world with Adderall.
Yeah. So that's how it started for you.
That's how it started for me.
So tell me a little bit about that.
I thought it was great because I was able to get more work done than ever.
And it's prescribed, right?
And it's prescribed. You know, I took it maybe 3 times from a friend of mine. And then I got prescribed. I was like, who's your doctor?
So easy.
So it's like, you know, and that's when you have to stop trusting all your thoughts, but you don't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's prescribed. I have a problem. Mm-hmm. It's fine. And it started with me controlling it one day yes, one day no, not on weekends. And that very quickly changed to, okay, once a day and never on weekends. That changed to, you know, once a day and on Saturdays. Right. And then Sundays was the only day where I would eat, but then there would be a dip in my just social levels and everything. So I would just put down my shades in my New York apartment and just eat and sleep.
Right. You needed to recharge because you're go, go, go the whole week.
Exactly. And then it changed into I needed it on Sundays as well.
Of course. Of course. I similarly had that issue, but mine definitely started with drinking. But then, you know, clearly I do have ADD. And so I found a friend who said, oh, you should be taking this. And I said, no, you know, in high school, my parents would never have wanted me to take anything.
Oh, yeah, no.
So I took it, and then it turned into the same thing. Like, I took it to study, and then I realized, oh, I can clean my whole apartment. And then I realized, oh, I can, like, stay out later, and oh, I can get drunker, you know? Yeah. And then it became, I took it during the day, but now all my friends want to go out, so let me take it again so that I can go out with my friends.
Yes.
And then, oh no, it's midnight and I got drunk already, so let me take one to sober up. And that's how mine progressed. Do you have similar?
Yes, and it was my gateway drug. Right. Adderall was, because when I was taking it every day and my body obviously needed rest, I quickly realized that having a glass of wine when I got home lowered the... Right? Because one's a depressant, the other one's up. So that became an everyday thing. I would be sitting in my office by 3 p.m. getting the crash from the Adderall. I could not wait to stop by the liquor store, get my wine so I could get home and level down.
Yeah.
And then that wasn't working anymore. So then I got into Xanax. And then the Xanax and the wine together, so dangerous, by the way, which I didn't know.
It's like Blackout Central.
How is the same doctor prescribing both of these things together?
Oh, well, I had that and I had two doctors
doing it.
Yeah, I had two doctors prescribing me both Adderall, Xanax, and then one of the, and Ambien.
Uh-huh.
And one of them had a different birthday for me. So I was, and CVS didn't care. I would pick up both prescriptions at the same time. How crazy is that?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I was struggling for money in California where my insurance didn't cover my Vyvanse. And I didn't care. I put all my basic needs on the backseat so I could buy my $400-something bottle of Vyvanse, which wasn't lasting me the month.
Wow.
Of course, at this point.
That's why I had two doctors. I don't know how I got away with it for so long, but I did. And, you know, I know that they've made the laws a lot stricter, thank God, really, because I think that it's so accepted. And I would hide it. I don't know. Did your friends, did your coworkers know you were taking Vyvanse and things?
No. Especially my friends. My friend group. From when I was healthy, when you're healthy, you surround yourself with healthy people. Oh, I would hide everything from them and got distanced from them even because I surrounded myself with people that were doing the same thing or worse.
Right. Me too. Same. It's really crazy how it progresses. Like when I look back and I think about, you know, how it started as you know, doctor prescribed, I need this, I'm taking it for school, I'm taking it for, you know, my test or whatever it is, and then quickly turns into, I need to sober up, let me take it. Or I have a hangover, I don't want to feel that, let me take it.
Oh,
or, 100%. You know, and in New York, the culture, I know now that there's a huge sober culture in New York, but I wasn't a part of that. So for me, the culture I surrounded myself was people who were doing the same thing. But I was very secret. They were doing like worse than me. So I was hiding the fact that I did these pills. And I was just like pretending that I only smoke pot and drink.
Yeah. And I mean, I was also doing really well in my career. You know, went up and up and up from different luxury brands. So you start lying to yourself.
Like, yeah.
If I have this job, then I don't have a problem.
Right.
I noticed Maybe I noticed in little thoughts that I had a problem and then quickly covered them up.
Right.
You know, and it's very much like if you wake up on a Sunday with a hangover, a normal person like orders food and watches. I had to take an
Right,
Adderall.
of course. They go to brunch and
Yeah,
stuff. Yeah.
exactly. Right? Or my brother's wedding. My brother's wedding, I had to take an Adderall to be
Present.
present.
Yeah, I can relate to that. So then what happened in the end? Like what were so tell me, we talked a little bit about how it's progressed now. Like tell me a little bit about what the culminating events were that brought you into recovery. Was it like you decided that you wanted to get help, or was it a, intervention style? Like,
It started as me wanting to get help. But again, like a huge theme with this is trust. I thought that what I needed was therapy and that I didn't have a substance abuse issue. So I took a medical leave from work. I could no longer be a functioning alcoholic addict. So my decision was to take a medical leave, but on my medical leave is when I was doing the worst. I decided to be a real estate agent,
Oh yeah, I did the
and I was taking the real estate exam. And mind you, I was a straight A student. I went out the night before, took two Adderalls to go take the test, failed.
Right.
Failed the test. I was like, this is not like me, you know. Nowadays, tomorrow, if I study for the test, I'll ace the test.
Right.
And that wasn't working out. So then I got a job with a neighbor of mine who put his name on the line. He had a big company to hire me. And one of those days when, I took an Adderall and then had wine and Xanax to calm down, the normal routine, I had conversations on the phone with his coworkers. And the next day, didn't remember what I said.
You were blacked out.
I was blacked out, but and they were all concerned, and I lost that job before I even got my first paycheck.
Right. So were those like red flags for you? Were you finally like, okay.
Yes, they were, but I still did not say I need rehab.
Right, of course.
So then I went home to Colombia and did therapy. I came to Miami. I support a lot of young girls in their careers and help them with their first jobs and their resumes. And one of these girls, she was hosting an event for a non-charity event, and I didn't make it. I had been drinking during the day, got really anxious, cried, excused myself. Like, oh, imagine having a mentor that does that.
Right.
And I called my best friend and I was like, I don't want to live anymore. I'm miserable.
Wow.
And he rushed over. And I really think this was a turning point. He called my mom. I was on a plane the next day to Colombia, and the entire time I must have been in bad withdrawals, but I didn't see it as that, only now with a clear head. I was shaking the entire time, and my mom's like, poor, seeing her daughter literally not knowing why. She
Right.
didn't know what I was using. And then we decided in Colombia when I was just you should see pictures. I
Pale,
look
thin.
pale, fat.
Oh, you were fat?
Yes, I was swollen. Let's not say fat. I was
Okay.
really swollen. Just I didn't look like myself.
Yeah.
Since I was little, I've loved makeup and hair and looking pretty and jewelry. I would wear the same sweats every day.
Oh, wow. That's so not like you.
I had like hair on my chin, didn't care, nails not done. I looked like a mess. And that's when my mom kind of went into survival. mode, yeah. Fight or flight. And she came with me to New York. We packed up the apartment and I moved to Colombia.
Wow.
This is all a blur. I was so sick that I have slight memories. I don't remember the plane ride. By this point, I hadn't been using for 3 weeks, which is a long time.
Yeah, that was, I'm sure.
Especially cutting out Adderall. I've never felt so depressed in my life.
Right.
No one talks about that.
Yeah, it changes your everything.
It changed my entire body chemistry, brain chemistry. When I got to my treatment center and they did the brain tests, brain mm-hmm. activity
like
tests.
Like neurofeedback.
Mm-hmm. And they see where red is in the really active areas of your brain and blue where it's underactive. And I remember the therapist telling me, your brain looks like an ocean, meaning there was no activity. I was just blah.
Wow.
Basically brain dead. And for someone who's so happy and active and... Oh, my dad calls me Maria Alegria, which means
happy.
Like happiness.
Yeah.
To be someone who's depressed and doesn't have activity in any part of her brain.
Yeah.
You know,
that's so scary.
Nobody talks about what years of stimulant use
can do. It really does. It damages your brain especially if you're abusing it, right? I mean, like, there are people who have ADD, who don't have addiction issues, that take Adderall normally and they're okay. You know, their brain is functioning. It's when you abuse it and you drink and you do Xanax. Cause you know, there's so many people that will call me and be like, hey, like I've been prescribed Adderall, but I don't overdo it. Like, do you think that's a problem? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, that's up to you, you know. Yeah. Do you really take it as prescribed or are you, you know, lying to me or lying to yourself, really?
I would have also lied to you, but not knowing at the beginning.
Right, right. Absolutely. So I think that people don't talk about it. And it's scary that they prescribe this medication to young children.
Yeah.
You know, and they up the dose consistently. I mean, that is really scary to a developing brain that like at such a young age, like to be altered like that. And and I don't know how it works because I'm not a scientist or anything like that. But I wonder if like your dopamine receptors can get damaged, like long term damage.
I mean, I've read a lot about it.
Yeah.
And it's not information that's out in the open as it should be. I mean, in my brain, it clearly, there's proof it had an effect. And they redid my scan 6 months in and there was some more activity in yellow and orange areas, but still very much.
I remember I used to be in my car and I would always take all my pills everywhere with me. Like all of them, like God forbid someone went into my apartment and like saw and they took them from me or thought I had a problem or something like that. So I would carry everything with me all the time. And I remember one time I was in the car and I was doing this like weird twisty moves because I was like in pain and my body was like breaking down. It was so bizarre. And I took the bottle and I looked at it and I read amphetamine. And like every time I read the word amphetamine, I was like, I know I have a problem. I know that amphetamines are bad. Like you learn speed is bad. And that word, like for some reason, that word would always stick in my head. Like this is bad. I'm not. So there was a lot of shame for me that was built up. And I felt like I really had to hide this part of my life.
100%. I went into treatment. And the person that did my take in, I just said, I just want to know who I am. I was so far gone. I didn't know who I was. Was I this person that partied till 9 a.m. in the morning and had no regard for responsibilities? I tried to look back at my childhood and it was such a different person. I'm like, who am I?
Right. That's scary.
That is, it's so scary. It's like being blind.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So tell me what, so now you're in Colombia. Your parents are aware that you are clearly, you have a problem.
At this point, I didn't tell them about the Adderall. Because, when I got to Colombia, I still had a bottle of Adderall.
Yeah.
And at this point, I was studying for my MBA. You're just grasping at things.
Because
you think something's going to work out, but really nothing's going to work out if you're in that,
I know.
So I'm studying for my MBA and we're in a little in the countryside on vacation, and I'm taking my Adderall to study for the MBA at this point on a medical leave. And me and my dad were sleeping in the same room. And when I woke up, he was very concerned. He's like, "You were shaking like if it was a seizure the entire night. I didn't know what to do."
You probably had Xanax withdrawal.
No, I did not have Xanax at this point. But I was taking Adderall and drinking on vacation. So we knew I had a problem, but
they didn't know.
So after this, I went to a center for addiction in Colombia. Mm-hmm.
Why are we laughing?
Because I'm laughing.
I don't know. I feel like that.
Because it's just coming back to me, and I got them to prescribe me Xanax.
Oh my God. Isn't that funny how that works?
And now the story became Veronica has a drinking problem. And I still didn't tell anyone about I told my therapist about the Adderall, and we dumped it in the toilet and did a whole, saying bye to it thing.
Okay. So you're just, lying to the people who are trying to give you some help.
Yes. And
I did that too in New York before I came down to Florida. And actually this is years before I went to treatment, like 6 years, 7 years before. I went to a plastic surgeon because I had lost a lot of weight, and I did some skin revision surgery, and they prescribed me, I don't know, either Vicodin or some sort of pain medication. Yeah. I don't even like pain medication. And the prescription was for 20 pills. And I made the 2 and 8. So the pharmacy didn't fill it. And I was like, "Why aren't you filling it?" They're like, "Oh, you have to contact your doctor." So I contacted my doctor, and he's like, "Listen, I won't report you if you promise to go to an addiction specialist." And I was like, "Okay, fine." He's like, "You have to go to this specific doctor. I know him, and he's going to report back to me, whatever." I said, "Okay, fine." I called that doctor. That doctor was like $800. And I was like, "Oh, I'm not paying $800. But I went because I was so scared that he was going to report me.
Yeah.
And the addiction specialist was like, "So tell me, about your lifestyle." And I told him that, like, drink once in a while, I smoke weed once in a while, and nothing else, right? It's like, "Oh, you don't have an addiction problem." He goes, "You're just bored." But poor guy, like, I didn't give him any real information, but
It's scary. It's scary. It's really scary because this center I went to in Colombia, they're known as, like, literally top two in the country.
Right.
And not only did they prescribe me Xanax, they told me that I didn't have a drinking problem, so I could start playing around with, maybe
moderation.
Yes, one or two drinks with family, which I did. Mm-hmm. And I told my parents, and it was true. My doctor said I could have one or two drinks.
Yeah.
At this point, this is when I knew I had a problem. I'm not taking the Adderall, but I have Xanax and
alcohol. Which
is
like the recipe for disaster.
I did not.
Oh, you didn't know?
No. I learned that in treatment here in Florida. I'm like, "Oh my God, the amount of times
is that why I was blacking out?"
And the amount of times I could have died.
Oh, yeah.
I never,
I thought in treatment, I told him I never had had a blackout before. And then people, I was sober and I went back to New York and people told me some stories and I'm like, what are you guys talking about? That never happened. Yeah. And they were like, yes, it did. And we three are sober and you were the one that was blacking out. So maybe you don't remember. And I was like, oh my God. And then I realized I had been blacking out for like years.
Yes. And that's one of the, I think that's one of the scariest parts that we try to ignore, but it's one of the things that now I wake up and I'm like, ah, I'm in heaven. That it's like, you don't wake up.
What did like, I do?
What the hell did I do?
Yeah. Oh, that's the worst. The what, like when you remember the night slowly in your head and you're like, oh no. And you cringe because you did something that's completely like out of character.
I think blackouts are like survival mode instinct to make you not remember the gross things that substances make you do.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe. I never thought of it that way.
Because sometimes I'm like, if, you know.
It's like your brain protecting you from like the really gross stuff.
They're gross. I'm not going to say it on this channel because they're rated R, but there's just really gross stuff.
Oh, I know. I know some of your stories. And, you know, but those are like the things that we have to keep in the forefront of our mind. And I remember we've talked about that, but like, that's what like I was told was like, keep those gross stories, keep the terrible stories at the forefront of your mind forever.
Yeah.
Because you start to forget them and they start to get less gross as you get more sober. Like, It's really scary how your mind does play tricks on you. And you're like, was I that bad? And then I'm like,
hell yes.
Let me remember. And I have a notebook. Yeah, I have a notebook that I've written them down. And now I have a file like on my phone where like just in case I'm in Greece and all my friends are drinking and smoking and thising and thatting. And I have a scary thought that I may be able to do that with them. Immediately open that on my phone and I'm like, nope. And then I make a phone call to someone to just like be like, hey, can you remind me that I'm crazy? Thanks.
Yes. And that's one of the most helpful things was to tell those scary stories to you.
Yes.
Because you can always spit them back at me if my mind plays tricks on me.
Right. And the fact that like I can tell you mine and that's how this program is so beautiful. And that's how this works is like recovery works because you meet people that are like just like you.
Yes. And the other thing that's helped me so much because I've had those thoughts, I'm still in early recovery.
Yeah.
And those thoughts come up all the time, especially after you're out of the recovery bubble and out in the world where, you know, it's in your face at all times is playing the tape forward.
Yeah.
I'm like, and now that I'm sober, I see people drink. And I'm like, that is not how I drink.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in a job now that it's all wining and dining. The teams do it.
Mm-hmm.
My first week.
All jobs are like that,
my first week, they took me to celebrate my job, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And there was alcohol in each.
Wow.
And I'm like, these people can drink and then go back to work and be super productive and not need. I would have maybe like canceled the day so I could keep going.
Right, exactly.
You know, or now that I've drank, I can't now take an Adderall and reverse the.
Yeah.
You know, it just didn't go with the flow of my.
So are you open about your alcoholism?
I was very open when I saw that this was the trend. I didn't, you know, sadly, there's this stigma against
there is
but I did say that I come from being in a really really dark place and being in treatment inpatient for 3 months, 6 months outpatient, still in recovery. This is my first job out of recovery and I can't drink.
Yeah
That's what I said without details.
Question: do they ever say to you like, oh, do you think you'll ever be able to? Or
yes.
How long do you have to do this for?
Yes.
Because I get that question. When I first got sober, I remember a friend of mine, and he's a really, really nice guy. And he's an older friend of mine, lawyer. He came down and We used to drink together in New York.
Yeah.
And he ordered a beautiful bottle of wine and he like poured me a glass. And I was like, no, I don't drink anymore. And he was like, he said this with all seriousness and with all good intention. He said to me, I really hope for you that one day we can drink a glass of wine together. And I said, I hope one day we can drink one glass of wine together too. Because I know in my mind
that's never going to happen.
No, one glass of wine, like that doesn't even appeal to me actually. Like I'm like, I want, give me the bottle.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never had one glass of wine, like period ends.
Exactly.
You know?
Same with me. Multiple times until I gave a little more detail was... Okay, so like, is this even my boss made a joke here because they love their wine.
Yeah.
So she was like, I wish I knew this when you were interviewing, you know, as a little joke, like we all drink. So I keep the lighthearted fun. I'm like, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't. And I say, and they ask one, will you be able to? We hope that we're the first people that you drink with. Like, no, you don't.
And not only that, but it's so weird. Like, just like, I don't understand that pressure because I'm just like, you do you. Like,
exactly.
Like enjoy your wine, enjoy your drink. I'm going to drink what? Like, why do
I'm
you
not even
need
looking
me?
At it at this point.
Yeah, why do you need me to drink with you is the
but
type
I just
of thing.
Go, listen, I've never felt so happy in my life, so I'm not going to dabble with. I listen to everything my therapist say because I might not be inpatient, but I still see the same therapist. And they don't recommend it, so I don't do it. And I make it funny.
Yeah, exactly.
And now,
I listen, unfortunately, not everyone is going to understand. And some people get really bothered by that, actually, but I don't.
But you know, I was one of those people.
So you
that
can't
I would
be.
Get bothered.
You can't get bothered.
I would, if someone wasn't drinking,
oh,
I'd be like,
oh, you mean that?
Yes, I would get bothered. Like, oh my God, let's say my brother was dating a girl that didn't drink. I'm like, are you serious? Like, imagine the problems she has if she's not drinking.
I don't know if that was ever me. I don't remember that because I was so like caring about like me getting what I needed in terms of alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
Getting high and stuff. Like, I know that if I was smoking, I'd be like, come on, smoke with me, you know? But anyway, the thing is like, so, you know, people though will get bothered that you don't drink. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to let that bother me. Like, mm-hmm. I don't care that it bothers you. Like, I'm just going to keep it rolling, you know, like I'm going to keep it moving. I'm going to do what I need to do to stay healthy because that's all we can do. So tell me more about like, what did early recovery look like? Or we're still in Colombia. So you're at this place, you're drinking with your parents. Like,
yes.
When did you end up going into like real residential treatment?
So my parents were going back and forth from Colombia to Miami. Of course, I had no friends in Colombia. So Colombia was my oyster to either choose healthy friends. And my mom and all her friends have very healthy, you know, people that they want me to be associating with.
Uh-huh.
But I go the other way. And I become friends with a drug dealer and his friends.
Oh, no. I can relate.
And I, you know, in one of those instances that they were gone, I had people over to the house and it was like 8 a.m. at this point when the housekeeper comes in. The housekeeper came in, we were all there drinking, doing God knows what, and she called my mom.
Mm.
And after this, my mom's like red flags went up and we all went to my therapist together.
Mm.
And then it happens again. And my mom at this point is watching me on the cameras that she has in the house. Like, why are you drinking right now?
Right.
And so it got to a day that she, I don't know what she saw on the cameras, but again, some of this is blurry. She flew on her and my father's 40th anniversary, June 18th.
Okay.
They had plans for their anniversary. She took a plane and came down to get me. She's like, you're not okay. We need to find something. At this point, she didn't have a plan. And my mom is a planner. And she was distraught. I've never seen my mom like that. And that shocked me the most. Like, I can't make my family this
upset.
I didn't even care at this point to tell myself I was okay. Right. I was just like, I can't hurt my family anymore. Mm-hmm. And my mom had a friend who had a daughter who struggled as well. And she called and said, what treatment center? And that same day we got me booked, paid whatever we had to pay to
a get billion me dollars.
Here. Oops.
It's crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And I was on a plane. I don't remember packing. I don't remember. The last day I drank was June 17th. And June 18th, I was packing. I don't remember this. I remember my mom packing my suitcases and saying, let's go get you a pedicure because you won't get one in a while.
Oh, my God. That's so funny. So, my parents were like, you need to go. We packed for you. It's in the car. This guy named Don is going to hold hands with you the whole way to Florida. And this guy, Don, was like 6'6". It's so funny because he's a client where I work now. And so sometimes he'll call in and I'm like, hey, Don, it's Irene. He's like, I just love hearing your voice, you know, because he gave me my first medallion. He gave me a 24-hour A medallion. And he was like, and I said, when can I drink again? And he goes, put this in under your tongue and you can drink again when it melts. And I was like, okay. And I still have it, of course. And I laugh about that. And apparently he says that to everyone. So so now you're in treatment.
Well, I'm in autopilot.
Yeah.
I don't realize that I'm in treatment. I don't realize I'm in rehab.
I don't know how far along I met you.
Again, you know, being sober for even like a couple weeks, the perfectionist is still there somewhere. Like
it blooms right back out again.
Yep, like pokes its head out, and I want to be the perfect student at rehab.
Yeah.
So we had to call women and we had to go out. So to me, it's like, I don't want to get in trouble or hit by a stick, you know, trauma from ballet.
Yeah.
So I reached out to you, but I remember, and this was a month in.
Yeah.
Maybe a month and a half.
Usually people call me a month in.
A month and a half.
Like they're forcing me to make phone calls.
Yes. It was a month and a half. And we went to coffee. We went to that place because you had to get desserts for someone.
Oh, yeah.
And we drove around. And you were like, so, like, do you think you're ever going to drink again? I'm like, honestly, yeah.
Yeah, I remember. And that's normal. Do you know how often I hear that?
But I really thought so at this point. And I'm already hearing
all you're like, I don't have a problem with drinking. I was like, oh, yeah, yeah.
So at this point, I'm like, okay, I only have a month and a half left. For me, rehab flew by.
Yeah.
And I'm having these thoughts, and I started being able to trust myself for the first time, only a little bit, in years, where I was like, my intuition says, don't leave yet. And that's when I was like, I need to go to sober living, mom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't trust myself.
Yeah.
So at this point, I didn't have a sponsor either.
Right.
Remember, and you actually said, like, I'm sure you were thinking she needs a sponsor.
Well, I mean, I always, you know, when someone says that, I'll offer or I'll say, it depends, right? It depends on, you know, because some people like want to be friends, and I'm like, we can't be friends if you want me to sponsor you, type of thing, right? So you got to choose one or the other, like.
But I was like, I want what this woman has after the first time I met you. Because when I told you I was going to drink again, you were like, you say that, but it gets so good. It gets so good. Life gets so good that you're not going to want to.
Yeah.
And now I chose to trust you. But that,
I'm so happy you did.
That thought blew my mind. But I right. chose to trust you because I'm at this stage a month and a half in where I know that I shouldn't have been trusting myself for years. Right. Well, let's trust someone else.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I am like crying every day of happiness because life is so good.
And it gets even better. You're still life, fresh.
Oh, life is so good. I was telling my boyfriend this morning about like achievements I've done in my job already, and it's only been a month. And I'm like, I would be CEO by now had I not tried any substances. And yes, my treatment center confirmed I do have ADD. But look at me, you know, you don't need it. And so like, I'm so happy I trusted you because life is so good.
I'm so happy to hear that. So tell me a little bit about like, what did early, you said you knew you had to go to sober living.
Yes.
So what did early recovery look like? Because, you know, you are still in early recovery. I know that. However, there's a difference between the first few months and where you're at today. And then there's going to be a difference in 2 years. And then there's going to be a difference at 3. It's so funny because like where I'm at today, like every year things evolve and change and grow. And my recovery looks different, you know?
Right.
And that's how it should be, right? We evolve as humans and our life evolves. And my spirituality has evolved. My meditation practice has evolved. My friends, a lot of them are the same, but some have changed, you know, some relapse, some stay in the program, some don't, and some die, you know, and that's the really sad truth of it.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what early recovery looked like for you.
So recovery really is unique to everyone. And for me, it was important to leave treatment inpatient. It was because my therapist knew I love comfort zones and I was really comfortable there. But I really did have such an issue with not knowing who I was and being so lost because in active addiction, I isolated. Mm-hmm. I isolated and that was my comfort zone. So I could go to therapy till the day I die. I love it. They're like, you need to step out in the world and you need to not even make friends, like interact with people. In active addiction, I would avoid my doorman.
Right.
I had the worst social anxiety.
Yeah.
So I got a job at Saks Fifth Avenue. And it was when I first started to, this is who you are.
Right.
You know, because you're getting constant feedback all day from your interactions. And I started noticing, like, wow, I'm sweet. I'm lovable. I'm dependable. You know, so you start noticing things because you're facing a mirror every day when you're in front of people. When you isolate, you know, you could believe whatever you want.
Right.
So that
and
was,
our minds could tell us tricky things, you know?
Yes. But I needed that because I was going to my job to interact with people, but on my own, I just wanted to go back and sleep. I had no social battery. It was painful.
Yeah.
To interact. It still is. And it's something I'm working
on. Yeah. It's something that, and that's normal. It's normal.
It's something I'm working on. But I started to get a lot of joy out of helping my roommates, the girls around me in early recovery as well.
Yeah.
Driving them places.
I know some of them. They're very sad that you now live in Miami and you're not there anymore.
I know. I know. Maybe I should come back for a couple more months.
Oh my God.
I'm gonna go back to treatment. No. Just kidding, Mom.
Yeah. So did you do any sort of 12-step program? Were you going to meetings? Do you work on a spiritual practice? Like, what do you do for yourself, for your recovery?
I was trying it all. So you're my sponsor. You give me the recommendation that has a lot.
Yeah.
And then I think you take the ones that really work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I hated going to meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's like, you're going to find one that you like. You're going to find one that you like. And I was going, I started hating them less.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say it was the thing that saved my life. I think when we spoke about spirituality, I was like, I'm spiritual. But it started becoming more and more and more and more a part of my life. Now it's huge. I start my day with, you know, the Instagram I sent you. I love my life. I love my life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I pray and I do notions and I dance and I really
that
feel
that little girl.
Like, yes, that's me. That's me. But I'm like,
that's
talking.
Old too. That's years old.
Yes, but I don't know.
She's
it feels
amazing.
Like me. That's what
I love
do.
My mom. I love my dad.
I love my
family.
Job. I love my sponsor.
I love that little girl.
I love my sobriety. And all this I'm saying to my, I'm spiritual, not that religious, but I'm saying to, you know, my angels. I believe I have my guardian angels. I speak to my great grandmother every day.
Yeah.
Every day now, you know, so my spirituality and getting that guidance from you that it, you know, it helps.
Yeah.
It helps when you know you're not in control to say something higher than me loves me
mm-hmm.
and is guiding me because it's not me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for something higher than me.
I love that.
So that to me, so helpful. And it keeps growing. My spirituality keeps growing. And it's really funny because my mom and I are alike in a lot of ways. And like just parallel to you, your family has their struggles through this. And my mom, her spirituality, her has just taken on another level. She also has addict behavior, so now she's addicted to her religion.
Yeah.
Like never, she does. My entire family, we have addict behavior. I see it now, like never before.
I know you can really see it once like, you've been to treatment, and it's a good treatment center that really you see all these different behaviors. It's amazing that I'm like, you know, it's funny. People are always asking me like, who in your family was an addict? And I was like, really? There's not that many. Like there are but not in my immediate family. Mm-hmm. Right. And then my dad and I were like talking once and I was like, oh my God, my mom is the addict. She has like a crazy addiction to shopping, like unhealthy. Yeah. Like there are consequences that she doesn't care about, you know what I mean? Like, and she'll do it anyway. Yes. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
What is this woman going to do when she doesn't work anymore?
Yeah, that's when you got to. Yeah. Me and my mom and my entire mom's side, it's like my aunt and uncle, it's chocolate and wine. Then it's eat three bars, not one.
Right.
And every day, three times a day. My mom, when it's Diet Coke, Diet Coke, Diet Coke. One time it was the tequila diet. Tequila, 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 tequila.
Now it's me. Yeah.
Now
yeah.
I tried chia seeds for the first time and now I have them five times a day, every day.
Yeah.
Or like I have an ice cream I'm obsessed with and I have to have it every day.
I was talking
it's
about this the
behavior.
Other day. Like, you know, you, yep. I call it hyperfixation.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Rather than it's okay. As long as it's not, you know, it's not drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think also early recovery, another thing that really helped me was our meetings.
Yeah.
Our meetings coming here. And I wouldn't open the blue book on my own. The big books.
Yeah.
The big matter. Blue book on my own. Like reading with you was so powerful to me.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear
and
that.
And there was little passages that, you know, made my hair stand up.
Yeah.
Or that you relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Or I remember when we were reading The Promises and my hair stood up and, you know, I got emotional and I'm like.
And they work.
And I'm like, when is this going to happen?
So then what would you say you do today that is different from then or that, you know, I know for me, spirituality has grown. I know for you, it's grown and it's a relationship, right? It's a relationship that grows. Mm-hmm. You have to feed it. You have to interact with it.
And you have to be patient and see things work.
Yeah.
Because it works.
Patience is the hardest thing, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm a very patient person, but it's like, when is this going to, you know, but then you see little things happening and happening and you see the power of You know, I'm such a spiritual person now that it's like the power of positive thought.
Right.
It works.
It does.
And but you have to
believe.
I mean,
it works for millions and millions and millions of people, and then it also doesn't work for some people. And it's whether or not you want it to, too. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to give it a chance, you know? And
yeah.
Some people aren't willing, and some people, you know, find another way, mm-hmm. you know, and that's okay.
Yeah,
you know, there are other 12-step programs, and there are also people who have found recovery not in 12-step. And that wasn't me, right?
Yeah.
And there are people who relapse from working, from, you know, whether they stop working the program or to stop whatever they're doing, but like that what did the 12-step route. And there are people who relapse who didn't do this 12-step route, you know?
It's very to the person. For me, my addiction stemmed a lot from deep issues.
Mm-hmm.
So without therapy,
yeah,
I wouldn't be here. And you know,
it's
I had two fabulous therapists, you know, who I worked with, that each one had their affinity for the different issues I'm going through, because I still see them. So in this stage of my still early recovery, I cannot let go of my therapy.
Yeah.
And especially what really works for me is coming, because I'm in Miami now, but driving back to my treatment center. There's a power in sitting in the rooms again and doing therapy there.
Yeah, there definitely
is. It grounds you.
Yeah. It also makes you remember where you came from and where you don't want to go to again, you know?
Exactly.
When I go back and sit in other people's groups, I'm like, thank you for having me tonight, because it's nice to be a visitor and I get to go back home to my dogs and my life. And I
can't believe I'm here and I'm like, you know,
yeah.
I watched your podcast and I was like, oh, I'm never going to be one of those. It's going to be like in years.
I'm so happy.
So you, you know.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm so happy you did. And I love you. And you look amazing. You are amazing. You shine.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I want to be on another one. This is not enough.
Okay. Sounds good.
Part two coming soon.
Yeah. Part two coming soon. We'll talk about other addictions. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.